All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah, decisions. Decisions, decisions, decisions. We got a lot of decisions to make, and we got to make them really, really carefully. And we have to actually think about what's going on in the country, what's going on in the world, and how we're going to make that all extremely different, how we're actually going to move on to a whole new way of living. All right? And that's part of what we're going to be talking about today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be having, I'm really, really happy about this. If you've been looking around and seeing, you know, different posters up here, and I should say to people who are listening to the show across the country, you have seen, it's unlikely that you've missed, these posters that go up. They have pictures of all the various candidates, the Democratic Party candidates, and then they have pictures of the Trump and Pence. And across each one are the initials BEB stamped on their faces. And people everywhere have been asking, what the hell is BEB? What does it mean? What are you talking about here? And this is going to be revealed today. For the first time, it's going to be revealed towards the back end of the show. And I'm really pleased to be actually helping to do that, having this show be a place where we can get this out and make it, you know, just out there for people, man, and really push this thing forward, because we are living in hell. You know, we're living in hell, and the rest of the world is living even worse than us, and the dangers and all the stuff that's going on, and the possibility. That's the other thing you can never forget, the necessity and the possibility of actually getting rid of all this and taking this to a whole new place. All right, so stay tuned for this, because we are going to be giving you a sense of all this, and we're going to be having, I'm really pleased that we are going to have actually the big reveal of what the hell BEB means, all right? And then we run with it, all right? So, and as you're thinking about this and everything that we're doing there, this is sort of the character, you know, this is the characterization of what we're trying to actually popularize here, all right? You think you're woke, but you're sleepwalking through a nightmare. This system cannot be reformed. It must be overthrown. The Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour is in town, sisters and brothers. So you watch for them. You look for them. You find out the ways you can hook up with them. All right. And this is what we gotta be seriously thinking about now. And before that, I'm really looking forward to this next section of the show, or the first section of the show, which is I had a chance to see a play shortly after it opened. It was a couple weeks ago, and it's called Canyon. I walked in, I wasn't sure what to expect, and I walked out just deeply, deeply impacted by it. I just thought it was one of the best plays that I've seen in a while. All right. And I was really pleased with it. And we are really lucky to be talking today to the playwright, Jonathan Caron, and his play Canyon. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Did I say your last name right?
You did.
Okay. All right. We got one thing going. All right. Well, let's jump into it real fast. Give people a brief synopsis of the play.
Play about a liberal couple that hires a handyman to work on their property, and in the process, he gets injured on the job, and their morals sort of fall to the wayside as they try to deal with the aftermath. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with the ways that we change when our ideals are kind of challenged and literally hit close to home in our own backyard, how we can rationalize or justify our behavior.
You know, it's interesting, because part of the thing that I found actually, and you know, I was just sitting there, and I was really bowled over by it. It was like, you know, because it's what you're saying, yes, but then there's also this fact that the play really powers up some of the sharpest contradictions in U.S. society right now, both currently and going all the way back to the early history of this country. It really does sharpen up some of the fundamental contradictions that the society has faced and has actually determined a lot of the ways things develop here.
It all goes back to land and land ownership, and I think purpose and what our purpose is and what our right is as Americans. It's you know, it's based on ownership of property has been the American way from the beginning, and the play tries to touch on that. And it's about a man who wants to build a better deck on his property and the entitlement that comes along with that. I like to think of it a lot as having a certain level of empathy for people who are in search of a purpose, and people who have the luxury to ask themselves what their purpose is in life, and how sometimes purpose can be our dangerous in a way to ourselves. And how I see in a lot of times in society, people are driven towards these goals that end up being destructive to others. So it feels like a very human thing for us all to want to have purpose, but sometimes that can mean our purpose at somebody else's expense.
Yeah, you know, it's something that you think about because, you know, people oftentimes, and I think this comes across in the play a lot, is that people oftentimes think that they're, in some ways it was interesting to me because people think that they're doing the best things, you know, like the husband and the guy who him and his wife own the house. And, you know, he's out there and he's like, he's, you know, working it up with the workman out there, the guy that's actually helping to sort of build additions and whatever to his house. And he's doing all that, but there's this dynamic that's operating there. There's like, you're watching this and you're thinking, okay, where is this going? But then you get this very, and I think this is what was really, one of the things that's really good about the way what you wrote here and how you did it is that even as you're watching this seemingly, okay, it's sort of a little bit mundane because, you know, the guy who's working there, who's responsible for doing all the work or on the house and on the patio and stuff, he's kind of like tolerating the guy who owns the house. And the guy who owns the house is kind of like, you know, I mean, he's just sort of nonstop. There's like, no, it's really, there's a certain sense, there's a certain entitlement that's going on, but also a certain mm-hmm. way of looking at the world. And I thought that was really interesting, that dynamic that you put in through there, because it operates throughout the whole play and between all of the characters in the play too.
It's hard to reconcile, but we live with these invisible class boundaries that in America we like to pretend aren't there, or that we're so progressive that we can see beyond them, but they still exist. And there's no stronger power dynamic than like worker owner. And I think everything in the play is the owner of the property trying to diffuse the power dynamics that naturally occur, but systematically he can't help but wield his power by the end of the play.
Mm-hmm. But there's also a thing. I mean, look, there's a constant. I mean, I thought there was a constant clash of outlooks in this, even if they didn't, if the person yeah. who owned the house didn't really recognize it, or even if I think to a certain extent, the guy who's the worker there didn't recognize it either. He got annoyed. He could see some foolishness and all this stuff. But it was sort of, there was this constant literally a clash of outlooks and experience that actually played out through the entire thing.
That was the result of a lot of learning on my behalf through writing the play. And someone, a playwright that I really respect, once told me, when you start writing a play, you've created a problem for yourself and you have to solve that problem. And in creating this play, I really had to solve the problem of knowing all the characters and their backgrounds. And through working with a lot of the Latino artists, was a process of discovery and learning and of cultural differences and the ways that they often feel and have to operate in the world. And I could never have taken this play to this place without them, without their insight, their dramaturgy, their stories. I think Jeff Rivas, the actor playing in this play, who's playing Eduardo, a lot of his stories about how he talks to his son in the play come from the ways that his father talked to him as a kid and the opportunities. And here he is now an actor, and his father was, you know, taking a lot of sacrifices so that he could have a life. And those are now funneled into the play. So the play as a sort of its architecture always stayed the same, but the intimacy of the characters' perspectives really came from the artists that I worked with on it. Mm-hmm. And that was a process that, you know, that just developed over time. So it's a really special group of people doing this particular play because they've been working with me for a couple of years now, and we've worked on it together. So I'm glad you felt the conflicting perspectives.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that came comes into play in the very beginning of the play and continues throughout, I thought, and in particular, as you're looking at how things are developing and what's happening between the people who own the land now, the people who own the house, the people who, you know, their friends that come to visit, and there's all very entitled, you know, and I rarely ever use the word entitled, you know, but there is a certain entitlement that people actually have embraced in relation to this. The people who are sort of in the upper class elements of you know, we're not talking about the major, you know, ruling class people. There's actually, mm-hmm. but there are people who actually enjoy the benefits of the society, and they don't really see that there's actually something else going on. And one of the things I really liked that you did, and it's almost sort of, it hits you after, actually sometimes afterwards, there's a little piece that's in the play, the arrowhead, you know. Mm-hmm. And what that symbolizes and what it conjures up for anybody who's actually, if you stop and you think, why is the arrowhead such a reappearing piece in this play? And it really does say something about what's going on in the social relations between the two groups of people.
It's this piece of the world that we don't think about on a daily basis. We don't think about whose land this used to be, whose land it is now. It's sort of in the argument about immigration that's like ongoing in this country. We don't stop and think about the fact that this land belonged to Mexico, that California and Texas, this was all part of Mexico, and the people who built up this land and built the missions and came in and built the agricultural systems were called Californios. And that's sort of a sense where history gets washed away, it gets sort of rewritten, and it's not that it doesn't exist, but the focus is no longer on it. And things like these arrowheads, these artifacts that we find are the remnants of the past in the play that you can't get away from, that you have to consider and you have to think about when you're making certain arguments about whose land this belongs to. Mm-hmm. So that's what it's doing there.
Yeah, yeah. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jonathan Caron about his play Canyon. You know, my wife and I were leaving the play afterwards, and we were thinking, you know, there was just so much to talk about, because you sat there and you watched it, and it sort of flowed over you, but then as you're getting wrapped up in that flow, then things are starting to be revealed, and things that actually make people uncomfortable, and things that, you know, I mean, for me it was like sort of, you know, I looked at it and I thought, okay, I'm watching this. I'm really glad that this is happening this way. But it's also, you know, it's something that it's the reality that we live in today, you know, because I also looked around the audience and there were some people who were not going to the place that I thought was a good place to go off of it, but they were looking at something else. And I thought go ahead.
Oh, no, that's part of what's so genius about the production, is that it's a collaboration between the Latino Theater Company and IAMA, which is an up-and-coming company in L.A., and the director staged this in a thrust, so that you are watching all the audience at the same time. And I think depending on who is in that audience, the tone and the energy in that room changes night by night. Because I think if there's a predominantly white audience, they're kind of more ready to laugh at themselves and, you know, enjoy kind of poking fun at each other. And then if it's a mixed race audience, suddenly that laughter is gone and they don't want to laugh. They're too uncomfortable too, because it exposes a certain privilege that they might have or something private. That suddenly it doesn't know if, you know, people don't know if they're safe. And then if it's a predominantly Latino audience too, certain things are funny that wouldn't be funny to a all white audience. So the makeup of the audience itself really changes the tenor of the play.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that really exciting night in and night out.
Yeah, it's a good point. And you know, the thing is that, I mean, for me, it was like, it's sort of like, look, we're, especially you consider that we're living in a time of Trump. And this play was what? It was written before Trump was elected?
Before he was elected.
Right.
Yeah.
But the fact that's sort of sitting there, and it's sitting even heavier now in terms of how things are dividing out in this society and what's actually being posed. And for all those people that, you know, you're referring to as like people might laugh for different reasons, but, you know, you look at this and frankly, I keep thinking that there's this chasm between how people self-identify and how the culture itself.
Chasm is the right word, because I don't think any of us see ourselves as the bad guy in any narrative. And sometimes it takes some introspection to look at it from a different perspective or from someone else's perspective. And that is, I think, essentially what we're trying to do with this play, is not give an answer for anyone or any one perspective, but to just show all the perspectives and have them all exist in the same landscape.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's interesting because actually it does, and including not just, you know, look, there's what happens to the audience, and I don't really want to give anything away on this, but because there's a development in the play that really kind of grabs you, and it grabs you in a certain way, and each person seeing the play is either they're there's blocks of people agreeing or thinking one thing. There's blocks of people thinking another thing. There's people trying to figure their way out, including actually one of your characters is trying to figure out, how did I get here? What did I do? How did I do this? You know? Yeah, so, it's sort of like... Yeah. He was sort of a guideline for a whole section of the audience when I saw it.
That's
like,
so funny.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of, you know, you're looking at this. And for me, I kept thinking, okay, you know, on the one hand, in my own understanding of it, I look at it as like, look, these things are rooted in this, the class relations that, you know, that are out there now. But then there's a whole thing of what you wrote about and what you put forward actually calls into question all of those relations, and people have to stand up and figure out what the hell they're getting behind. What are they looking at? What are they acting on? You know, and I think every one of the, like, for the people that are the upper class people whose house it is and their friends, they actually are, you know, I think it's interesting because on the one hand, they are the people who are acting on this thing. And at the same time, they have no sense. They think they're the victims, you know, which...
We have to talk about this, and we have to coexist. And so this is a conversation that has to happen because there are going to be people of privilege and people who are marginalized, and they live in the same world, and we live in the same city. And so a conversation has to exist so that some of the private shame or personal feelings on either side are expressed and shared and acknowledged. And I'm hoping that this is a forum. This is a little... spot in LA that we can come together and start to talk about these things and talk about how we're feeling on either side, mm-hmm. and allow that to be reflected in a story. Mm-hmm. So,
all right,
that's come see it, please.
Yes, absolutely. And in the end, I do have to say this, and we're rushing. Our next guest is actually pulling at the door here.
Okay.
So, but I want to make this point, and it's in the end, we do all have to, and this is what your play made me think about. In the end, we do all have to make some kind of decision about where we are, what we'll do and what we'll tolerate and what we want, the kind of world we want to live in. And I thought that was really expressed very well with your play.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank
sure. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, man.
All right.
All right, Jonathan. Talk to you again with your next play, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, take care now. Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jonathan Caron, whose play Canyon is currently running in Los Angeles. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Function Underground. All right, now I'm really pleased to be bringing on to the show someone who's a guest and also is a host on WBAI in New York, Sansara Taylor. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, I'm so glad to be with you.
Yeah, you too.
I'm here at City Hall.
What did you just say? I couldn't hear you.
Oh, really? I'm out here at City Hall
with
the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour. We are live from the rally. And it's about to be the public national what the hell is BEB reveal. So I know you want to know what the hell is BEB.
Yeah.
Your listeners want to know what the hell I'm talking about.
That's right. I am particularly interested.
Yeah. So let me explain that just so everybody's prepared. We're doing a live rally. And any second when the main speech I'm going to cut in, we're going to broadcast it. So I'm standing with my eye on the rally. But basically... there's a nationwide tour that is kicking off of revolutionaries and communists out here to let the world know that you think you're woke, but you're sleepwalking through a nightmare. This system cannot be reformed. It must be overthrown. We need an actual revolution. And we're traveling the whole country to organize thousands into the movement for an actual revolution. That is the revolution being led by Bob Avakian and the new communism. So we've been all over the country, actually, even before we launched this tour, with this great mysterious poster of all the 2020 contenders. It's got Kamala Harris, it's got Elizabeth Warren, it's got Bernie Sanders, it's also got Donald Trump and Mike Pence, and each of them have stamped on their faces a big stamp that says B-E-B. And we've been taking guesses, and people have been buzzing on the internet, people have been trying to figure this out on college campuses. B-E-B was raised as a sign behind Bernie Sanders' head when he spoke at his kickoff rally in Brooklyn, and people have been trying to figure out what B-E-B is, and so we're here for the public reveal. It's a great turnout here at City Hall, the Revolution crew, and that's, you know, the RevComs are going to announce our plans in relationship to the 2020 elections. That's what's about to go down.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're now just so people are clear, I don't know if it was actually, I can't remember whether you actually said this or not, but it's City Hall in Los Angeles, and this is one of the first places that this is actually, this whole operation is opening up on, right? This is where it's beginning, and then it's going to go through the entire country, right?
That's right. That's right. We're doing a year-long nationwide tour to organize thousands into the real revolution to overthrow this system at the soonest possible time, and so we're in Los Angeles as the first leg of this national tour for about 6 weeks, maybe a little longer. And we're going on the campuses, we're going in the neighborhoods, and we're telling people, look, you know, you think you're woke, you think you're good, you think you're voting for change, you think you're organizing in this way or that way, but really we got to get down with the fact that this system cannot be reformed. You can't put an end to the white supremacy, the crimes against humanity waged by this country around the world and its military, that the Republicans are fascists, but the Democrats are also a machinery of war crimes and crimes against humanity. It's the system that is causing these crimes against humanity, and it's the system that's destroying the planet. And so we're really, as a part of the kickoff, challenging people. It's been fun as this DEB poster. We've taken it to campuses, we've taken it out, and we're showing people all these candidates, Democrats, Republicans, women, people of color, men, and asking them to figure out what do they have in common and what might BEB stand for. And so we've been building this up across the country for the last month or so. And right now people are sending in guesses on the live stream of this event on Facebook. And in just a minute, we're gonna reveal the answer. People have there's a lot of funny guesses being thrown around. Bobble-headed empire builders. That's one of the guesses. There was somebody else, and I'm having a hard time hearing it and talking with you at the same time. But yeah, so this is about getting serious. And after our rally, there's actually a big around the world. There's a walkout for the climate today with students, and this is really important. It's part of why we need a revolution. It's part of, you know, the Trumpsters, the fascist Republican Party is straight up denying the thing of the existence of climate change. They're ripping up environmental protections. They're accelerating drilling and destruction. But then you have the Democrats coming with this pipe dream of a so-called Green New Deal, which is just a sort of an American chauvinist jobs plan that doesn't measure up to the real depth of the crisis. So it is aimed at pacifying people and putting them back to sleep. So we're here to talk about the fact that only by getting rid of the system that is the source of this problem. Oh, they're revealing BEB right now. They're tearing it open. Okay, hold on.
All right.
I'll go look at the sign. I'll tell you what it's saying.
All right.
They're tearing it open. They got the big banner. Oh, it's bourgeois electoral BS. I'm giving you the radio clean version. Bourgeois electoral BS.
All right.
Bernie Sanders is BEB, bourgeois electoral BS. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is BEB. And they're chanting, LOL, OMG, what the hell is BEB? But they've revealed it now. Bourgeois electoral BS. Oh, they're chanting it. It sounds really good. The people walking through the park are gathering and laughing. There's a lot of smiles happening here.
This is great. This is really, you know, it's interesting because I was watching this as we went along in the past couple of weeks and just like all the guesses that people were making. And this was extraordinary. Actually, I think it's really.
You know what? We're gonna go live. And if there's, hopefully this is a broadcast, this is going to be Andy Z, who is one of the people helping lead this generation revolution too.
From the National Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour, Andy Z is an advocate of Bob Avakian's new communism. He's a spokesperson for Revolution Books. And he's going to share a word with you about the role of elections and the understanding of elections in relation to revolution, real revolution. Andy Z.
All right, thank you, Noche. How are you all doing?
All right.
Okay, so let me restate the message from the RevCons on the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour. The 2020 elections, as in all elections, are nothing other than bourgeois electoral bullshit. And once again, we'll rephrase that for the radio M4 TV. The elections, as in all elections under this system, are bourgeois electoral BS. These elections are nothing other than a brilliant device to rope you into complicity with great crimes, a circus to make you think you have some say in what is going on. They are a way to bamboozle you, to deceive you, to make you think you are doing something, and to put your stamp of approval on great, great horrors. And as Noche said, we are on a tour to spread this revolution, to spread the work of Bob Avakian, to spread the fact that there is a way out of this madness.
Through revolution for a radically new society based on the new communism. And the stakes could not be higher for humanity around the world, as well as here in the United States, where a fascist regime is in power. That's the Trump-Pence regime. This regime is step-by-step consolidating a fascist regime, a white supremacist fascist regime. And the Democrats have no answer for this. Nancy Pelosi has said that impeachment is off the table. Why? She said because it divides the country. Get real. Get real. When you have Nazis marching in the streets with torches saying the Jews will not replace us, slurring and attacking homosexuals, marching under the banner of the Confederate flag and white supremacy. This country is divided. As Bob Avakian has said, hell, Trump makes use of these divisions in pursuit of his fascist agenda, but neither he nor anyone else has caused or could have caused these divisions. They are rooted in the very nature, functioning, and requirements of this system and the way all of this has historically evolved. To eliminate these divisions, it is necessary to eliminate the system.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
The Democrats have told you, and they have shown you, that they have no answers. Think about that. Confront it. We are facing, as I said, a fascist regime. The Democrats blather on about governing and promoting wish lists like the Green No Deal, which will solve the environmental crisis just about as well as Obama solved the crisis of police shooting black and brown youth, which is to say, not at all. But no, you would rather believe in make-believe than get out of your comfort zone and face reality. And this is not the first time in history that we have seen such a movie. This system and the media mouthpieces have you thinking about an election contest in which you really have no say in what is going on. They have you in a game show. A game show of America's got imperialist and wannabe imperialist talent, as you can see up here. Do you want to be part of that same crew of oppressors by giving them your stamp of approval?
Oh!
You think you're woke, but you're rooting for Bernie. You're cooing over AOC. You're following Beto's existential crisis on the internet. But you are sleepwalking through a nightmare. This system cannot be reformed. And look, the stakes are such as whether or not this planet will even be habitable for human beings within 50 or 100 years. You cannot change your light bulbs and tax carbon as a way out of this. You need an entirely different system. We have a problem with the environment that is caused by a dog-eat-dog system that depends on fossil fuels and the fight over who controls those fossil fuels. We have a problem that turns water into a commodity around the world. This is a system. We need to overthrow this system, and that's why we here are out on tour to say to everybody, this system can't be reformed. We have to overthrow the system. We need an actual revolution. The 2020 election, as Moshe said before, the Republican Party is fascist. The Democratic Party is also a machine of massive war crimes and crimes against humanity. This system cannot be reformed. We need an actual revolution. The 2020 elections, you wanted some evidence? I'm going to give you some evidence. But I need a third hand. When I'm done, I want you to pick up a copy of this newspaper, Revolution. You will see this centerfold that says the Republicans are fascists, but the Democrats are also a machine of war crimes and crimes against humanity. And you need to go through this. You need to see that over the last 60 years, 70 years, the crimes, the murder, the death, the plunder that has been caused by both parties, from Yemen, more recently from Obama, the Iraq War, all the way back to the bombing of Hiroshima. Look at these facts and then tell me that you can rely on the Democrats to resolve the things that you care most about. You cannot, and it will never happen that way. We need an actual revolution. Okay, now we've had some fun with this BEB, hashtag BEB. We're not done having that fun, but we're actually talking about some serious stuff here. We do face a fascist regime. As peculiar, petty, lunatic, and bizarre as Donald Trump and Mike Pence are, what they are doing affects the reality. The reality they're bringing about affects the lives of millions of people, billions of people. And as the organization Refuse Fascism has said, Trump's Make America Great Again plan is a 21st century fascist program of America First wrapped in the flag of Mike Pence's Bible taken literally, with a program of white supremacy, misogyny, and xenophobia. And in opposition to this, the Democratic Party, where all too many people are putting their money, their resources, and their hopes, is acting exactly like the progressives and the moderates did in Germany 80 years ago, 90 years ago, when they conciliated and collaborated with Hitler's regime, with the result being tremendous horrors for humanity. And the heart of this, the reason they don't have and can't have any answers to all that plagues the people, is because the Democratic Party is a ruling class party whose purpose is to enforce and reinforce the system that gives rise to all of this here and around the world. And that's what's shown in that chart. That's what's shown in that chart. Any party that is seriously promoted by the media in this country, that is seriously in power, can only be a party of the ruling class. And unless that's what you want to be, a wannabe plunderer and oppressor of humanity here and around the world, then you need to get with the revolution. There are three futures facing us. The first future is a fascist regime, with all that that means. The second future is putting your hope in complicity with all of this in a Democratic Party that has brought you the same, and people around the world, the same oppression and plunder. Or you can get with the revolution and find out about Baba Vakin and the new communism, find out that there actually is a way for humanity to overcome all forms of exploitation and oppression. That is not an impossible dream. It's a hard road, but it's a possible road because of the very problems that this system generates and the sentiments that people have against it. So we have hit the road organizing this. And some other people here will tell you about, we have an opening celebration next weekend. Now, I just want to say two more things. One thing is, that part of fighting for this revolution is recognizing the danger of this fascist regime. And if you take the conclusion of what I said, that you can't rely on the Democratic Party, then what can you rely on? Well, you can rely on ourselves, on yourselves. The only way that we are going to stop this regime is not the 2020 election, but by millions of people, starting with thousands, gathering in city streets and squares around this country in nonviolent, continued, sustained protest day after day, demanding that this entire regime be removed. That is the program of Refused Fascism, and those of us in the RevComs support that and want to work towards that, even as what we are telling you and what we're working for, and that's part of the road to a revolution for the complete emancipation of humanity. We are on the road to organize you into the thousands for revolution. We are on the road to tell you that there is a way out of the madness. We are on the road to tell you that there is a third future, that neither one of these ruling class parties. Oh, you're stupefied. We need to unstupefy the people with revolution. Okay. So with that, I want to turn this back over to Noche and get you into the revolution. And as the sisters and the brothers...
All right, sisters and brothers, we got you've heard the word. You've heard the word now. And it's... You got to actually, people have to actually think about what they're going to do in relation to all this. People have to step up in the way that's actually needed, all right? And we will have this entire speech available on my website, hopefully by no later than late tonight or tomorrow morning, but we'll have it posted up there. And you should check it out, listen to it again, spread it around to people. And this is a time for people to be thinking seriously about what the hell is it going to take? And when there was a call put out for people to actually stand up, and I think this was very heavy, for people to stand up and join the revolution. Join the revolution. That's what it was being called for. And right now we're going to have a last word from Sansara Taylor. Sunny, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Michael. I don't know, were you able to broadcast that presentation?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, so this is beautiful down here. There's a beautiful, spectacular, I wish you could see it. We'll send pictures of it on social media.
Okay.
A really powerful scene here. And I think what we just heard from Andy Z was very sobering and liberating truth about people are getting played, millions and millions in this country. I'm sure a lot of listeners, most listeners, care deeply about the climate destruction, the future of the planet, about the white supremacy riding high, about the war crimes in Yemen backed by the U.S., by the crimes against humanity this country has waged and carried out around the world and is now threatening Venezuela. People care about these things, and yet they're getting roped in time and time again into the BEB, into pouring their money, their hopes, and their conscience into the Democratic Party, into one road or another of trying to elect a new face on top of the system. And guess what? It keeps being the same system. We had a black president. It didn't stop black people from being gunned down by police, locked up in massive numbers. We had women in power. Hillary Clinton was perfectly capable of carrying out war crimes and crimes against humanity. We need, instead of BEB, instead of bourgeois electoral BS, we need to get serious about the actual overthrow, the actual revolution that can emancipate humanity. And that's what this revolution tour is about, spreading the leadership of Bob Avakian, somebody who's actually done the work to develop a strategy and an approach and a constitution for a new socialist republic, a whole different way the world could be. So we're not, 50 years after the Black Panthers, we're still seeing Stephon Clark gunned down in his grandmother's backyard, more people sobbing and burying their relatives, the same crimes they stood up against 50 years ago. Well, 100 years past the founding of International Women's Day, and rape is a worldwide epidemic. Yeah. This has got to stop. Playing this game, going on this hamster wheel of the BEB time after time, it chews you up, it spits you out. By the time you're done, it's not just wasting your efforts. You're putting your stamp of approval on it. You're giving it your legitimacy. You're voting for it. And we're saying we got to get out of that. We got to get organized to overthrow it because the future, the planet does not have that much time left, and it's not necessary. It's just not necessary for billions, 65 million, to be being driven from their homes. It's not necessary to live in a world where women are afraid to walk down the street at night. This is not human nature. It is not necessary, but it will continue as long as this system continues, and people can't keep pouring their energy into the BEB. It is harmful. So this has been a beautiful unveil. We are having a mass launch and welcome to the tour on March 23rd. So it's going to be a picnic, a barbecue, a welcome. We're going to have a short excerpt from the speech, why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution, from the most radical revolutionary on the planet today, from Bob Avakian. We're going to have the Revolution Club. Come and be part of getting organized, learn about this revolution, and get out of the BEB and get into something serious.
Okay. All right, Sansar.
Join us.
Thank you very much for joining, for bringing this to us. It was really an incredibly important and inspiring listening to the speech and talking with you. So let's get into this.
Well, thank you, Michael.
That was Sansara Taylor, recorded live from the steps of City Hall in downtown Los Angeles. Sansara writes for RevCom.us and is an advocate for the new communism forged by Bob Avakian. She's also a co-founder of RefuseFascism.org and the host of We Only Want the World every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. on WBAI in New York City. Thinking about the opening interview with playwright Jonathan Caron, I'm reminded of something Bob Avakian, B.A., said in a talk he gave titled Making Revolution and Emancipating Humanity. He made the point that in this society, people confront each other as owners and non-owners of things that they exchange in order to be able to survive in this society. There is an appearance of equality in the course of all this, but that actually covers up the reality of profound inequalities and relations that are grounded in the exploitation and oppression of the many by a relative handful. Thinking about this, I went back to a piece by B.A. that I listened to recently speaking to this point. We have some time left, so I thought I'd play this excerpt from the Revolution Talk, why it's necessary, why it's possible, and what it's all about, a film of a talk by Bob Avakian. This is What is Capitalism? Parts 1 and 2.
As I said, I'm going to talk about how all these things flow from the very nature of the system and why it cannot be reformed. It must be done in and done away with. We need a revolution, the most radical revolution in the history of humanity. If you want to eliminate a problem or an evil, you must get to the root of it. If you want to eliminate the oppression and miserable conditions of the masses of people in the world today, you have to dig down to the underlying foundation, the ground in which this oppression and misery is rooted, and which continually gives rise to this oppression and suffering. You cannot get rid of a poisonous plant and create something healthy in its place just by pulling up the top of the plant. You have to pull it up from the roots and then grow something completely different and change the soil too. That is what a radical solution is. Radical means having to do with the root. And this is why a real revolution is needed, and this is what it's all about. Now, fundamental things about the world are hidden from us. Fundamental refers to the foundation, like the foundation of a house or another building, the thing that everything rests on. So what is the fundamental thing about how the world works that is hidden from us? The fundamental thing that goes on in the world every day that enables human beings to live and have a society is the exchange of labor among people. Now, like I said, this is not at all obvious. If there were only six people in the entire world, or we had six people just by themselves living together, this would be more obvious, because then the six of them would get together and they'd say, okay, what are you going to do? Maybe you're going to go out and hunt for food. Maybe you're going to go out and find materials to build a house. Maybe you two are going to work on constructing the house. And you would see how everybody's labor, in one form or another, contributed to people being able to survive and interact with each other in a society. But we don't have six people in the world. We have 6 billion. And they live not just in one little place, but all over the globe. But still, the same fundamental thing is going on. If you go to work, you put in a certain amount of work. You get back a certain amount of money in exchange for that work. You go buy certain products at the store or whatever, and then you take them to your house and use them, and you exchange things in that kind of a way. This goes on in such an everyday way that we don't even stop and think about it. But you are actually exchanging things indirectly through all these different stages with people all over the various parts of the globe. Think about it this way. Don't do it right now. But when you go home, check out your clothes. Look at the labels on them. Don't just look at where it says what company brand is on the clothes, but look where it says where these clothes or other things you have were made. In Nicaragua, in Honduras, in Haiti, in Pakistan, in Egypt, all over the world. We are exchanging things, and ultimately and fundamentally we're exchanging labor. People in those countries are putting in a certain amount of labor, and we're putting in a certain amount, and that's being exchanged through the form of the way in which we buy things with money. But it's not very obvious, because partly they want to keep it hidden from us, and the other reason is there are things that get in the way of our seeing that very clearly. First is the fact that there are all these intermediate steps. We're not the six people directly exchanging labor with each other. We're exchanging money, getting something. The remote character of where it came from is not obvious unless you do go read those labels, for example. So that's kind of one thing that keeps it hidden from us, is that here's somebody working in a sweatshop in Pakistan making the shirt that you wear, and you're over here putting in a certain amount of work so that you get the money to be able to go to buy that shirt when it gets to a store that you go to. You're exchanging the labor you put in for the labor they put in to make that shirt, but it goes through so many stages in between that you don't see that. But the other thing that gets in the way, and today the more significant thing, is that each of these steps, someone steps in and says, wait a minute, that's mine, I own it, I'm going to sell it. Not you who made it, me who made you make it. That someone is the capitalist. That's the system we live under. We don't work and exchange our labor directly, or we don't even exchange the products of what we produce with our labor directly. Some capitalist takes it at each stage, says, this is mine, and sells it to someone else. And down the line it goes, each time going through another capitalist. But this is what's underlying all that. As I said, go look again at your clothes. Think of the small children who were working 12 and 14 hours a day making those clothes for pennies an hour, if they get that. See if you can see the tears of the children and their blood and bones that go into making those things. See if you can hear the muffled cry and the moans of those children as they're forced to work under these conditions in order to try to live. So what is this wonderful system under which all this takes place? What is capital, and what is capitalism as a system? Capital is a relation of domination, of exploitation, and capitalism is a system based on exploitation. Sometimes people think of capital as money. You hear them talk on the financial channel, oh, he has so much capital, meaning so much money to invest. And money is one form that capital takes. But that is not the heart and not the essence of it. In a deeper sense, money is only the outward expression of capital. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I've talked a little bit about the exchange of labor between people, the muffled cries and moans of the children who make all, not just the clothes, but many of the other things we use. But let's ask another question. The stock market with its clanging bell we hear about all the time. What are they trading on the stock market? Where does the wealth come from that they're trading in when they buy shares and stocks in different companies and bonds? They're trading in human flesh. They're trading in human suffering. They're trading in what's drained out of those children and out of other people, with their bones literally broken and their skin literally going into the things that are produced. That's where that wealth is created before the capitalist takes it and says it's mine. That's what they're trading in on the stock market. They're trading in exploitation and degradation of people all over the world, including tens of millions or hundreds of millions of children. Another way to get at this money is the outward expression. Look at your money. Who's on it? Mostly dead presidents and slave owners. But are they the ones that created the wealth either back in slavery days or today? Of course not. So what should be on the money to really express the actual relation of things? Who should really be on the money? The little children, the slaves, and others who have been enslaved and exploited and degraded in this way. That should be on the money to tell us where the wealth really came from. And along with that, when we get to it, we'll put people who have led slave rebellions and uprisings and revolutions against this system on the money, as long as we have to use money. Capital is not machinery either. Sometimes you hear people say they got so much capital, got so many machines in the factory or the workshop or whatever. Machinery, after all, is made by people, through the labor of people, like everything else, like those clothes. Somebody made those machines. They didn't appear magically out of somewhere. So once again, when you look at a machine, any kind of machine, including a car or a computer or a CD player or anything, think of the fact that this machine is just the product, the physical embodiment of the labor of the people who made it. Once again, use your imagination and look for all the people in many parts of the world with their skin and their blood, their bones and their suffering that have gone into making all those machines. At the same time, machines are not necessarily capital. Machines are just machines. Whether they are capital or not depends on whether or not they are made under the capitalist system. Under another system, the system of communism, machinery would be made in radically different conditions, for radically different ends, and would belong to the people, not some capitalists who step in to expropriate them, to take them as their own at each stage of the process. Capital is a relationship in which one person or a group or class of people owns and controls the means to live and the means to create wealth, and thereby forces others to work for them in exchange for a wage. Capital is the control over this labor of others, and it is this, making others work for you, that creates the wealth that the capitalists get. Capitalism is a system in which everything that is produced and exchanged among people is a commodity. And this includes people's labor power, that is, their ability to work. That, too, is a commodity. It is bought and sold under the system, the capitalist system. And when your labor power is bought and you are put to work, the capitalist who buys your labor power controls you and what you do while you were working for him. They'll even have his slave drivers in a modern form tell you how long you can go to the bathroom or whether you can go to the bathroom. And really, the capitalist class as a whole controls your very life, has the power of life and death over you, because they determine whether or not you can even have a job. And they control you if they give you a job, quote unquote. Capitalism then is a form of modern day slavery. It is wage slavery. That's why I know, at least when I was coming up, people used to regularly refer to a job as a slave. Yeah, I got me a slave, I got to go off and work. But you weren't literally owned. You just produced the wealth and then you could be fired. But let's back up a second and dig down further into the foundation of this. What is a commodity? You hear that word a lot. What is a commodity? Well, let's take an ugly example to start out with. If a woman makes love with a man because she feels like it and because they care about each other, that can be a beautiful thing. That can be an act, an expression of love, an intimacy between two people who care about each other. But let's take a situation that happens all too often. You're in a housing project or somewhere and you've got to get to work. Or your kids are sick and you've got to get them to the hospital, and you go running out to get to your car to drive your kids to the hospital to get to work, and your car doesn't work. And you know some guy down the street who knows how to work on cars, and you go to him and you say, "Would you please help me get my car going?" And he's not thinking the way he should be, and he says, "All right, I'll help you, but you got to give me a little something, something." Now, you know this happens. And this is turning what should be a beautiful thing, an act of intimacy between people, into an ugly thing, into a form of a commodity, into which two things are being exchanged for each other. He's helping you with your car, but you got to give him some sex that you may not at all want to give him. Let's take a more commonplace example of commodities. Let's say you grow tomatoes in your backyard. And you eat them yourself, you put them in salad, you give them to your kids, you invite your friends over, and you all eat them. Well, that's not a commodity. Why not? Because the person who's making them, you, is just using them directly. You're not exchanging them with anybody for anything else. If you invite your friends over, if you're a good friend, you don't say, "Give me some money for these tomatoes." You just give them some tomato. So a commodity, then, is not something that's produced to be used directly by the people who produce it. It's something that's produced to be exchanged either directly or through money, is the more common way these days, for another something, another commodity. And one of the things about this is, because it's not made to be directly used but to be exchanged, is you get the separation of usability of this thing from its sellability. And sellability rules over usability. Now, what am I talking about? Let's say you're really good at making chocolate chip cookies. You make chocolate chip cookies, everybody loves them. Your kids love them, all your friends love them. You make them and eat them all the time, maybe more than you should. But then one day, one of your friends trying to do you a favor says, man, these chocolate chip cookies are really good. You ought to sell these. You could make a lot of money. You could be famous like Famous Amos. So you go along with it, you think, well, yeah, let me try it. So you make some chocolate chip cookies and you put up a stand, and sure enough, people come over and buy from them, and they love your chocolate chip cookies. But then you're out. So what are you going to do? If you're going to keep going with this, you got to go back and buy some more flour, and you got to go back and buy some more butter and some more eggs and some more walnuts and some more chocolate chips, some more sugar. And then you start making more chocolate chip cookies, but then you run into something. When you're trying to sell these, you run into all these big companies. They already got a Famous Amos out there, and they got other people making these on a massive scale in factories and everything. So you can't make enough to compete with that and to sell them cheaply enough. So then you start saying, well, maybe I better hire somebody to help me make these cookies. Or you get an idea, maybe I get my kids to help me. So you get your kids, you start making them, but you're still up against these big companies out there making these cookies. And after a little while, your kids say, we're tired of this, you know, can we have something to eat? And you say, kids, sellability, sellability, not usability, sellability. And they look at you and they say, huh? And you say, you're eating up the product. Well, see, this is what it means to get caught up in commodity production and exchange, and you can see what it starts leading to. You either get bigger or you get eaten up. You better go back to just enjoying your own chocolate chip cookies.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my guests today, Sansara Taylor and Jonathan Karen. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Actions Speak Louder Than Words.
Louder than words.